and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the thuggery displayed by the Republican candidate for Congress in Montana and look into how much the millionaire Greg Gianforte models himself on the billionaire Donald Trump. And in body slamming The Guardian journalist Ben Jacobs, who Gianforte's office claimed is a liberal reporter, how much has Trump's rhetoric in casting the press as the enemy of the people trickled down to not just GOP candidates, but to the party's grassroots? Trevor Tim, a columnist for The Guardian and executive director of the Freedom of the Press Foundation, joins us to discuss how dangerous it has become for journalists to ask questions in Trump's America and how Trump's inflammatory attacks on the press and reporters seems to be emboldening GOP activists and politicians to mete out frontier justice. Then we will speak with Charles Kupchan, who was Director for European Affairs on the National Security Council during the Clinton administration and spent the last 3 years as a special assistant to President Obama for national security. He joins us to discuss Donald Trump's scolding of NATO allies over defense spending and the disconnect with the Trump administration's priorities as they throw more money at the Pentagon while slashing funds for soft power in the face of a sustained and effective Russian propaganda and active measures assault on the U.S. and Western Europe. Then finally, we'll examine the hunt for a terrorist network underway in the U.K. following the horrendous suicide bombing in Manchester. David Shanzer, director of the Triangle Center on Terrorism and Homeland Security at Duke University, joins us to discuss how the British handle the some 300 former ISIS jihadis who have returned from Syria and Iraq compared to the US and the current focus on who made the bomb that was used, as well as the likelihood that the bomber had training in Libya, where he was for the past 3 weeks before returning to the UK just days before the attack. And joining us now is Trevor Tim, a columnist for The Guardian and executive director of the Freedom of the Press Foundation, a nonprofit that supports and defends journalism dedicated to transparency and accountability. His latest article at The Guardian is "The Trump News You Missed: He Asked Comey to Jail Journalists." Welcome to Background Briefing, Trevor Tim.
Thanks for having me.
And this is an extraordinary event that took place yesterday in Montana, where the Republican congressional candidate, who's pretty much ahead in the polls, Greg Gianforte, grabbed the Guardian reporter Ben Jacobs by the neck and body slammed him to the floor, injured his elbow and broke his glasses. It was all recorded on audio tape, but was also witnessed by a Fox News crew. What was extraordinary about it was, of course, that Gianforte's people immediately put out a ridiculous version of events that said that Jacobs was the aggressor. He was labeled him as a liberal journalist, attacked this poor man, and all this kind of crazy partisan stuff. But we don't know at this point, do we, that whether or not he's going to win votes or lose votes. What's your take on, because the polls will close, I think, in a couple of hours from now.
Yeah, I mean, I think that time will tell. You know, there was a couple people tweeting last night that the campaign and its supporters were knocking on doors, actually playing back the audio tape for voters, and that they were saying that people were switching their votes on the spot. But, you know, again, this is anecdotal evidence, and it's hard to tell, especially given that Montana has early voting and that it happened so close to the election that it's hard to know how many people actually hear about it. I mean, there was reports today that actually one of the main television stations, which is owned by a right-leaning group in Montana, was refusing to even play the audio tape. So I think it remains to be seen if this will actually affect the vote. It was already going to be close anyways, but it is just a truly almost unbelievable story. You know, the fact that this reporter, Ben Jacobs, who my colleague at The Guardian, went up to the candidate and, you know, as you can hear on the audio tape, was really just politely asking him questions. It didn't even sound even moderately aggressive. And the candidate just snapped. And you hear this crash and, you know, Ben screaming out in pain. And, you know, as you mentioned, probably one of the more surprising elements of the story is the fact that Fox News journalists witness it as it happened and reported that it was even worse than the description that Ben gave, which was that he was actually being punched while he was on the ground. So it was just an extraordinary series of events, and you know, really demonstrates the really troubling environment that reporters are living and working in these days, even in the United States.
And of course, the fact that the Fox News crew gave an honest accounting, which led to the police charging Greg Gianforte, was not reflected in Fox News's flagship coverage at the network level, which of course, but in Montana itself, even though it's late in the day and a third of the votes are being cast by mail ballot, nevertheless, I believe all three major newspapers in the state did come out criticizing Gianforte. So it's hard to know where we're heading there. But let's talk a little bit about the broader environment, because, Trevor Tim, this is not the first incident of harassing the press, violence towards the press, arresting the press. We know that Donald Trump has cast the press as the enemy of the people. At Eddie's rallies, he's called out people and almost sicked the crowds onto them. Several journalists have had to be escorted to their cars by Secret Service agents, etc. In West Virginia, a reporter was arrested on May the 10th trying to ask a question of the Health and Human Services Secretary Tom Price. And I could go through a whole bunch of examples. So is there a connection here between Trump's rhetorics and hostility towards journalism?
You know, it's hard to say for sure, but certainly it feels like that this constant drumbeat from Trump that he is at war with the press and that they are fake news and liars, and that, you know, every time that they try to expose him or do expose him, that he goes on these, you know, just terrible rants about how terrible the press are, that is, you know, filtering and leaking down to these local events where reporters are more and more being treated like second-class citizens, almost, just for asking questions. You know, like you mentioned, there was this event that happened right around the time that James Comey, the FBI director, was fired by Trump, and that was obviously taking up a lot of the news coverage. But there was a reporter in West Virginia who was literally arrested for asking the Health and Human Services Secretary, Tom Price, a question about health care. And Tom Price then went on television and actually praised the authorities for arresting this person. You know, at the FCC just last week, a reporter was thrown up against the wall by security and ejected from the building for asking a question after an event. And, you know, you really have to wonder, is this the environment that Trump is creating with all of this dangerous rhetoric?
And, of course, Ben Jacobs, the Guardian reporter, asked a question about health care as well. And as you pointed out earlier, it was not exactly a hostile question. And that led to him being grabbed by the neck, thrown to the ground, kicked, punched, etc. I mean, it's a very odd situation. Now, what I find extraordinary, though, Trevor Tim, is that you could maybe expect this from some crazed grassroots activists, but from GOP politicians and cabinet members, that's a whole different matter, not to mention from the President of the United States himself.
Absolutely. I mean, it is literally politicians' jobs to answer questions from reporters. And public events, they have to be prepared to be peppered with questions from any type of reporter. And the fact that Ben Jacobs can go up to a candidate for office and ask him about, which was literally the news of the day, the CBO, the Congressional Budget Office, had issued a report on the GOP health care bill, which said that, you know, 23 million people were going to lose health care coverage if the bill went through. The fact that he was totally not just unwilling to answer, but reacted in a physically violent way is incredibly disturbing. I mean, this is a person who is going to face dozens and dozens of reporters every day if he gets elected to Capitol Hill. And, you know, the fact that he would react like that, it really boggles the mind.
And again, I'm speaking with Trevor Timm, who is a columnist for The Guardian and executive director of the Freedom of the Press Foundation, a nonprofit that supports and defends journalism dedicated to transparency and accountability. His latest article at The Guardian is "The Trump News You Missed: He Asked Comey to Jail Journalists." Let's talk a little bit about that, because that's another aspect of the hostility that Donald Trump has expressed towards the press. But in this case, it goes further, where he casually asked former head of the FBI, who he recently fired, about jailing journalists, as though that were a perfectly reasonable thing to do.
Yeah, this is, you know, kind of the natural culmination of everything that Trump has been saying for the past year. You know, during the campaign, he was almost on a daily basis insulting various members of the press, calling them human piles of garbage and the enemy of the people. He was calling for the change in libel laws so he could sue the press who write stories they didn't like. And this was actually the thing that at Freedom of the Press Foundation we were most worried about, was the fact that Donald Trump, when he has the awesome power of the FBI and the Justice Department behind him, could potentially try to arrest and prosecute and jail journalists who publish classified information. Now, this is a right of journalists that is protected by the First Amendment, but there is a law on the books called the Espionage Act, which is written incredibly broadly, that would, if just taken by the letter of the law, would mean that dozens and dozens of journalists are breaking the law all the time. And given that leaks and stories out of the White House that contain classified information are really, taking apart the Trump administration right now, piece by piece. I mean, the New York Times and the Post are doing some incredible journalism around the Trump administration, and it is obviously driving him up a wall. And so, we always suspected that he might go down this road, but to hear that he actually asked the FBI director, or the ex-FBI director, to literally jail journalists, I think sends a chill down everybody's spine.
Do you think he knows anything about the First Amendment, about the Fourth Estate, that the relationship that's existed for the longest time? I mean, I know that's not to suggest that, you know, Obama wanted to jail reporters, James Risen, for example, for leaks. So he wouldn't be the first president to go after leaks, but asking to jail. And what was exactly... Who was it that did he mention to Comey who he wanted to jail, or was it just a broad brush of just journalists in general?
I think it's just, as far as we know now, that it was just a broad brush of journalists who are publishing these leaks. And there has been a tradition in the U.S. for at least 50 or 60 years that, yes, it might be that the people who actually leak this information to journalists are breaking the law. But it's generally understood that the First Amendment protects those who publish those leaks, the journalists and the publishers themselves, from prosecution. And now, it's hard to discern if Trump knows anything about any law, and that he just sees this as something that is becoming a weight on his presidency. And the fact that there is a blockbuster story that gets released pretty much every night by one paper or another, sometimes all of them at once, that it is slowly driving him crazy. And, I think that, it's in a vacuum very disturbing and bizarre to hear a president openly say that he wants a jail journalist. But it's really just the natural culmination of what he's been saying for a year and a half now.
So do you think that that this is going to lead to something serious? You know, some of his supporters are pretty, some of them can be quite unhinged. He has a lot of support amongst the white nationalists. They're a pretty heavily armed group. I'm just wondering at what point there will be some responsibility taken for the rhetoric. Maybe this character, that if he gets elected, it's certainly going to be... dogging him when he's in Washington, Greg Gianforte. But my sense is, from what I've read about him, is that he sort of sees himself as kind of a mini-me to Donald Trump. He's a millionaire to Trump's billionaire, and sort of models himself on Trump. And Trump's son, by the way, campaigned with him. So I'm just wondering whether this will be an opportunity. Well, two questions here. One is, do you foresee the possibility of somebody taking the law into their own hands, having been given license to go after these enemies of the people?
Well, I mean, just look at what the candidate said after this event happened last night. I mean, you mentioned it earlier in the program, but he didn't show any contrition or apologize for assaulting this reporter. He actually doubled down and lied about it and said that it was actually the reporter who was aggressive. And you know, the tape and all of the eyewitnesses from various news organizations completely refuted his story. But it seems that he doesn't seem to care at all. And I think that that's almost the more worrying aspect of this story, is that he doesn't care, and that a lot of GOP politicians in Congress were making light of this story today. They weren't, you know, strongly condemning it like they should. And, you know, given the environment we live in now, I it is certainly a big worry that something like this could happen again, given that the GOP has become so hostile to just answering simple questions.
Just in the last couple of seconds, then, do you think that this guy is modeling himself on Trump? That's some of the reports I've read.
It certainly sounds like it, and especially if you take into account last night's events, the fact that he would so brazenly lie about this, even though we had a tape, the fact that he had no apologies for literally assaulting a journalist. You know, we can go back to all of the campaign rallies where, you know, it seemed like Trump was trying to rile up the crowds to do something similar. It can be a very dangerous situation for journalists. And, you know, that certainly comes with the territory for being a journalist. And so I think it's really up to the citizens themselves to really rise up against this and say that this is totally unacceptable. And I really hope that the voters of Montana express that later tonight.
I thank you very much for joining us here today, Trevor Tim.
Thanks for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Trevor Tim, who's a columnist for The Guardian and executive director of the Freedom of the Press Foundation, a nonprofit that supports and defends journalism dedicated to transparency and accountability. His latest article at The Guardian is "The Trump News You Missed. He Asked Comey to Jail Journalists." We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into Donald Trump's scolding of the NATO allies over defense spending at the NATO summit. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Charles Kupchan, who was the Director of European Affairs on the National Security Council during the Clinton administration. He's now a Professor of International Affairs at Georgetown University School of Foreign Service and spent the last 3 years as Special Assistant to President Obama for National Security. Welcome to Background Briefing, Charles Kupchan.
Happy to be with you.
Well, thank you, Charles. And what did you make of Donald Trump's scolding of NATO at the NATO summit in Brussels?
Well, he harped on the question of defense spending, and he's right to do so in the sense that most of America's NATO allies do not meet the benchmark that they've agreed to, which is to spend 2% of GDP on defense. Only 5 of 28 members do, including the United States. So this is something that he's been pushing on since he was a candidate. Obama, when he was president, also pushed allies on this, and hopefully there will be progress. The commitment is for everyone to get to that 2% benchmark in the early part of the next decade.
And, of course, one of the video incidents that is getting a lot of publicity and going viral is Donald Trump elbowing, I believe he was elbowed the Montenegrin minister out of the way in order to reach out and shake hands with somebody. What did you make of that?
I haven't actually seen that video,
right.
So it's hard for me to comment. But you know, Montenegro is not yet a member, so it may have been that there was a protocol issue involved. I'm not sure what happened there.
Right. Well, he certainly got treated like he wasn't a member. So, of course, the other aspect of today's NATO summit, in contrast to Donald Trump, was the appearance in Berlin on the anniversary of the Berlin Wall coming down of your former boss, President Obama, with Angela Merkel, who looked decidedly happy to be on stage with him. I must say, in stark contrast to the photo ops following her White House meeting with Donald Trump, where she looked rather glum and he was even more glum. So what did you make of that?
Well, you know, I think this is just one of those accidents of scheduling. The chancellor had invited President Obama quite some time ago, and it just fell out that it was the same morning of the NATO summit, which took place in Brussels later on in the day. And there's no question that Obama and Merkel have a very close friendship. They grew into confidants as well as friends over the last several years of the administration. And Obama also remains a very, very popular figure in Europe. And that makes it easy for Merkel and just about every other politician in Europe to want to stand or sit next to him. The same is not true of Mr. Trump. Mr. Trump is not a very popular figure in Europe now because of his positions on climate change, because he has said some rather unkind things about the project of European integration. He earlier said NATO was obsolete, although he seems to have changed his mind of late. His positions on immigration and refugees, on a budget that hits those most vulnerable abroad and in the United States. There's a long list of complaints that Europeans have. So in that sense, you had two presidents in the continent, one very popular, one not so popular, and that was pretty evident from the photo ops.
And of course, Donald Trump was also a huge supporter of Brexit, which is... It may not have affected NATO quite so much as it certainly has undermined the EU.
Well, you know, there was an earlier meeting prior to the NATO confab between Trump and the leaders of the European Union, President Tusk and President Juncker. We didn't get much of a readout about what was discussed, but I'm sure one of the issues on the table was the president's views, President Trump's views about European integration, because he did say that he was a fan of Brexit, and he quietly seemed to have supported Marine Le Pen in the French election, although Le Pen lost. And that gives Europeans pause. It makes them feel like what they consider to be one of the great accomplishments of the last century, a Europe that's democratic and at peace, is no longer supported by the U.S. president. Trump does seem to be evolving. He does seem to have discovered that NATO ain't such a bad thing after all. When the Italian prime minister was here a few weeks ago, he said that he wants Europe to be strong. So I do think that the first few months of the administration were sufficiently a train wreck that the president has tacked in a more conventional direction, and I'm hoping that that more conventional approach to foreign policy was on show in the private discussions that he had in Brussels today.
And again, I'm speaking with Charles Kupchan, who was director for European Affairs on the National Security Council during the Clinton administration. He's now a professor of international affairs at Georgetown University School of Foreign Service and spent the last 3 years as special assistant to President Obama for national security. So without venturing into amateur psychiatrics, what do you make of Donald Trump's sort of craving for adulation? Obviously, he's got an oversized ego. He does spend an awful lot of time insulting people, but at the same time, he seems to be somebody that wants to be loved and enjoys flattery. Was there any sense of what was happening in Europe that maybe, you know, he's sort of repairing some of the earlier insults. What was your takeaway in terms of body language? And obviously, we talked about the scolding that he gave mm-hmm. NATO allies over their defense spending. And as you pointed out, that's nothing new. Obama did mm-hmm. the same thing. But I'm sort of trying to get a feeling for, because I think what I see in this president is that he's a guy that came out of real estate and business and was used to being the big dog, if you will, and the main yeah. guy in the room who gets to order everybody around and everybody bows and scrapes before him. But in the White House, because he's so ill-equipped and frankly quite ignorant, he finds himself as not the smartest guy in the room, but perhaps the dumbest guy in the room.
Well, you know, I think that he wants to be a success, and as you put it, he wants to be liked and perhaps loved. And as a consequence, he has gone through a learning process, which is to some extent on show this week. He, number one, has demonstrated a discipline that we have not seen to date during the Trump presidency. His tweeting has been kept to a minimum. He has stayed more or less on message, and it's clear that his staff didn't want to give him opportunities to speak in an off-the-cuff way because there were very, very few press availabilities during this whole week. And he seems to have been able to deal with large multilateral conversations. There was a large grouping in Saudi, and then the NATO summit is 28+, and he's about to go to a G7 tomorrow. Because of his business background, I think he's someone who likes to do it one-on-one. I don't know what the conversation was like in Brussels. Haven't heard any readouts yet. But at least he was able to pull this off. There was no great disaster, no big guffaw that tripped him up. And so I know that's a pretty low bar, but at least he seems to be able to handle the basics of going abroad and going through a host of meetings with foreign leaders.
And, of course, back home, he's, in effect, escaping from this continuing scandal vis-a-vis possible Russian collusion in the election. And there's a lot of investigations going on, as we know. And that raises a question in general. From day one, he could have put this whole thing to rest. He has not acted like somebody that's being unfairly accused of something, but rather he's sort of been in cover-up mode from the very beginning vis-a-vis the Russians. And my sense of it is that this is not going to go away. And the one thing that I think John Brennan made and he's cleared in his testimony was somewhat ironic. He said, you know, I called up the head of the FSB and read him the Riot Act and said that the American people are going to be outraged if you meddle in our elections. And as it happened, the American people haven't been outraged. It's become a partisan issue. So, mm-hmm. So my question to you would be, well, at what point does it cease to be a partisan issue and become an incredibly important issue? Because it's obviously the same thing is happening in Europe. We know that the Russians interfered in the French elections, the Dutch elections, and the upcoming German elections. So as somebody that's been involved in Europe for some time and with NATO, surely this is a new part of this kind of post-Cold War landscape of hybrid warfare. This is the gray area that the Russians seem to have stolen a march in. So I can't imagine why this is not a priority in terms of discussions, not just about 2% defense spending, but about, you know, what the threat yeah. matrix is.
Well, you're right to point out that the Russians have gotten a step up on the rest of us on this front, in that it's not just the hacking and the interference in democratic elections in the West. They are also very good at propaganda, at getting the message out. Russia Today, Sputnik, social media sites. They've got political operatives all over Europe, and their ability to kind of affect political narratives and debates is running way ahead of us, partly because they are happy to have state-controlled media, and thank goodness we don't believe in that. But I do think that Trump has only made matters worse for himself by not coming clean and not providing whatever information is needed. And you have to ask, if there's nothing to hide, then why did so many Trump people hide the fact that they were meeting with Russians, from the former National Security Advisor Flynn to Jared Kushner to Sessions to others? It just makes one wonder, what's going on there? Why don't they just tell the truth if there's nothing to hide? I do think that we're kind of hitting a political inflection point, that with the appointment of the special prosecutor and with revelations coming out day by day, he may be hitting the skids, as it were, in a sufficient way that Republicans may start backing away from him. And if that happens, then he's in a very, very treacherous political position. I don't think we're there yet, but one can begin to feel that the political winds are shifting here in Washington, D.C.
But then why is it that the U.S. and the West isn't better, not so much at propaganda, because that has a connotation of being falsehood and lies, but as in effect projecting the values that the West has and that the United States still has? In other words, what does Russia offer? I mean, you know, you've got a kleptocracy with the Siloviki stealing the country blind because of state control of media. Putin is able to beguile the people into believing that he's you know, a hero. He's got something like 80%, although I don't believe that to be the case, approval. They don't produce anything. They're not going anywhere. There's nothing after Putin. He's there, a dictator for life, but obviously he's not going to be there forever. And they've created so many problems with their neighbors, in particular Ukraine, that they're turning a lot of Eastern Europe against them. So I don't see that, even though we talk about how the Russians are much more successful in this new hybrid warfare landscape, in the broader context, they're not successful at all. Their economy is somewhere between Italy's and Canada's.
I would completely agree with you. I mean, the country is totally reliant on energy income. There's no knowledge economy. Their industrial base is going nowhere. And that's part of the reason that Putin is governing on the basis of this kind of Eurasian populist nationalism, because there's nothing else there. The problem is that they're just very good at controlling the airwaves and the media and getting their people into important places, particularly in Western Europe. And we haven't figured out how to fight back effectively. Part of it, I think, is we're still novices when it comes to the whole question of cybersecurity and retaliation. What was the best way to push back against Russian hacking and the release of emails from the Democratic National Committee? And as I said, you know, we don't really believe as Western democracies in state-controlled media, so we're still trying to figure out how to get our message out more effectively. And there have been some steps forward by getting funding from Voice of America and Radio Free Europe for broadcasts in Russian to Russian speakers and ethnic Russians in Europe. And I think also part of the problem has been the internal difficulties, economic difficulties here in Britain, in Europe, the deindustrialization, the sort of downward slide of the middle classes, which has simply opened them up to populists, to people like Le Pen, to those who argued that Britain had to leave the European Union for, quite honestly, under false pretenses. But the Russians are very good at kind of taking advantage of the political dysfunctions that are resulting from the economic downturn and from the debates that we're having internally over immigration and security.
Just in the last couple of minutes, though, Charles Kupchan, it would seem, though, that in the context of our conversation, then everything that Trump is doing makes no sense. While asking for 2% increase, or asking the Europeans to pony up to the 2% they've agreed to, he's also adding $54 billion to the defense budget, which is already extraordinarily high. And that is the equivalent of what the Russians spend per year on defense. But at the same time, he's slashing entirely the soft power budget from the State Department, just eviscerating that. And that's led to over 100 senior military officers complaining, saying, this is crazy. You know, so this is what I find extraordinary, is that if we're losing what you refer to as the kind of propaganda war, for the want of a better description, why in God's name are you cutting our legs off when that's the real arena that we should be competing in? Because you can't really compete with nuclear weapons. We've been down that road before, and mercifully we survived.
Yeah, I mean, I completely agree. It makes no sense to be pouring billions more into the military rather than into the civilian side, the State Department, AID, broadcasting. Furthermore, and I'm hoping that this came up in the conversations today, we need to do a better job on the quieter security side, intelligence sharing. In Europe, there are still big gaps between the member states of the EU in sharing basic information about passenger names, about law enforcement. And as we saw a couple of days ago in Manchester, we're paying a price for the fact that we haven't really deepened cooperation enough across our intelligence services. So that's another place where we should be leaning in and not leaning back.
Well, Charles Kupchan, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
It's been my pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Charles Kupchan, who was Director for European Affairs on the National Security Council during the Clinton administration. He's now a professor of international affairs at Georgetown University School of Foreign Service, and he spent the last 3 years as special assistant to President Obama for national security. We can take a brief station break. We'll be back examining the hunt for the terrorist network underway in the UK. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is David Shanzer, who's a professor of the practice and director of the Triangle Center on Terrorism and Homeland Security at the Sanford School of Public Policy at Duke University. Previously was the Democratic staff director of the House of Representatives Committee on Homeland Security, and served as a legislative director for Senator Gene Carnahan, counsel to Senator Joseph Biden, and counsel to Senator William Cohen. And his positions in the executive branch include special counsel to the Office of the General Counsel and at the Department of Defense, and a trial attorney for the United States Department of Justice. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Shanzer.
Thank you so much, Ian.
And what do you make of the situation in the UK in terms of how perhaps they handle things differently from how we do things here in the United States? Obviously, at the moment, following the Manchester bombing, there's a hunt underway to find a network that might have helped this bomber, the suicide bomber, Salman Abedi. Apparently, 8 people are in custody. Then the authorities are looking for a possible bomb maker. Clearly, Abedi looks like he was sort of the patsy in this whole thing. But my understanding is that there are about 300 returnees, jihadists, if you will, who have returned from Syria and Iraq in the UK. And I'm wondering, I'm assuming that that's a part of the network that they're looking into, if it is indeed a network. But how do the British handle returnees compared to the way we do here in the United States?
Well, in the United States, we have a law called Material Support for Terrorism, and that means that you can be convicted of a pretty stiff sentence, 15 years in jail, at least, for providing any sort of labor, money, aid in any way to a listed terrorist organization. And ISIS, Al-Qaeda, and many of its offshoots would certainly qualify. So if we had information that anybody, and we could prove that anybody was actually connected to or working with a foreign terrorist organization, had helped them in any way, and we knew that they had come back into the United States, we could arrest them immediately and prosecute them. And I think the laws in the UK might not be as strict in that regard, and the levels of proof might be required to be much greater. And so they're left having to, you know, conduct surveillance, try to establish that they've committed a particular crime under British law, and then bring a prosecution if they have.
Well, that would mean, though, my understanding about surveillance, if you have a suspect, a terrorist suspect, if you want to have 24/7 surveillance, and these terrorists, particularly those, and this fellow apparently spent some time in Syria and might well have been trained by Daesh, the Islamic State, they are trained also to be as inconspicuous as possible and as secretive as possible in terms of whatever plot they're hatching. So my understanding is that you need a minimum of 6 around-the-clock surveillance people per target.
Yes, absolutely. It's very expensive to do 24/7 person-to-person surveillance. You know, maybe less so to do different forms of electronic surveillance on specific targets. But there's no doubt that it's resource intensive, and the resources of the intelligence agencies, the domestic security services, are stretched. Of course, what France has done in the aftermath of the Paris and other attacks is to declare a state of emergency, which has allowed detention on much less of a basis, much more military activity inside the country, powers to detain individuals for longer periods of time without appearing before a magistrate. And the UK tightened up its terrorism laws in the wake of the 7/7 incident. So we'll see what Parliament does in response to this particular tragic episode.
And again, I'm speaking with David Chanza, who is Professor of the Practice and Director of the Triangle Center on Terrorism and Homeland Security at the Duke University. Previously, he was the Democratic Staff Director for the House of Representatives Committee on Homeland Security, and he was also a Special Counsel to the Office of the General Counsel in the Department of Defense and a trial attorney for the United States Department of Justice. So, we understand that the British authorities did have this fellow Abidi somewhere on their radar, but it does look as if he was the sort of patsy, and that the real people who are planning this, particularly the ones that made the bomb, have yet to be found. And we don't know about the relationship to his own family in Libya. The father and the brother have been arrested by Libyan authorities. So how do you do counterintelligence and counterterrorism with these targets who don't seem to be necessarily exhibit? You hear conflicting stories that this young man was a very mild-mannered, you know, sweet guy and all this kind of stuff. And then one or two people said, well, he was at a mosque, and when the imam made a speech hostile to the Islamic State, he gave the imam a very hostile look. But this seems like little threads. You know, in general, it doesn't look like anybody really tips their hand in these operations. So how do you do this kind of surveillance within, you know, the bounds of civil liberties?
Well, first of all, I'm not ready at this stage to say that somebody who plays an explosive device in a concert full of young girls is a patsy of any sort. We know that he did it. Now, whether he was under coercion or not, he still did it. So that's first. Second of all, you know, MI5 had been tipped off by the family. It appears, and this is all from press reports, we don't know for sure, on at least one occasion, maybe on two. How recent those tips were is, again, something that I think will come out in investigations later on. So he was on the radar screen. You know, the Boston Marathon bomber was on the radar screen. The Orlando shooter was on the FBI's radar screen. So that means it is difficult to follow everyone who you get tips on. In my view, I think the most important link here is continuing to work with, educate, build trust within communities where these people live and interact. I don't want everybody to be a spy on their neighbor, but everyone in society, American society, British society, certainly has an obligation to point out individuals that they believe are moving down a dangerous pathway, whether they're going to commit violence or they're having mental health difficulties or other issues in their life that need to be addressed. And it seems from the press reporting that a number of people had concerns about this individual. Whether they had any inkling that he was going to do something as heinous as this, you know, I doubt it. That said, if we have programs, procedures, protocols, and a sense of partnership and trust between communities and law enforcement and local government authorities, then we can begin to build a network of resilience against this network of violence and extremism that appeared to be dominating this individual's life. What we need is to be able to intervene earlier before the plots are in process.
Well, I think I mischaracterized the idea that he's a patsy. So obviously he did a horrible thing, and he knew what he was doing, and he paid the ultimate price in terms of killing himself. But of course, it was a terrorist.
Good choice.
Yes, and it was a terrorist attack designed to be as heinous as possible. It's no accident that they chose a bunch of innocent school kids. My sense is that he was below the radar, and that you know, he wasn't out there sort of preaching jihad on the streets as some of the others. That there was a very controversial imam that was running around the streets forever in the UK, preaching all kinds of hate speech, and eventually took years to round him up. So that seems to be a pattern, though, that you keep hearing, well, you know, this has caught us all by surprise. You know, he was a nice lad, etc. You hear that a lot. So that does...
Well, he had a criminal record. He had some evidence of gang activity. You know, there is no profile or pattern that you can say somebody that engages in these activities, you know, that person's going to become a violent extremist. But it does turn out that when you go back, a lot of violent extremists had engaged in criminal conduct in the past. Often they've been victims of some form of childhood trauma. I find it very interesting that this person's parents, I mean, he's 22, so he's a young adult. He's not a kid. But in 2011, his parents left him in the UK and went back to Libya. You know, that's what the parents of the Tsarnaev brothers, the Boston Marathon bombers, moved back to Russia, leaving their two children in the United States. This is a big challenge, and I don't like to go backwards after an incident and point fingers at the law enforcement authorities or intelligence authorities and saying, well, you missed this, you made a terrible mistake. I think we look at every single incident, we look at, you know, what kinds of factors there might have been to draw attention to this person earlier on. Could they have done more to intervene or more to gather evidence on this particular person or people who were like him? Similarly, do they need more personnel? Do they need more resources? We are never going to be able to prevent 100% of these incidents. But obviously, we need to, you know, learn from incidents and try to improve performance.
And what do you make of this flap over the publishing of the pictures of the backpack tattered, the one that it had the explosives inside of it? That's got everybody weighing in, including President Trump at the NATO summit, complaining about leaks. The British, I don't believe they're cutting off the flow of intelligence, but what would have been, would that leak have come from somebody on our side who was given top secret intelligence by the British and then sort of tattled to the press?
I believe the New York Times reported that it came from a U.S. intelligence source. We don't know whether it is somebody who's a professional law enforcement career, intelligence department, Homeland Security, or whether it went up the chain to somebody who's more of a political appointee. We don't know at this point. I think there's a fair question on whether the photographs of the specific evidence should have been published by the New York Times. I personally don't see the news value in the pictures of the specific uses of the device when the bomber is, there might be hot pursuit essentially of the bomb makers or the people who contributed the parts to the bomb. So I don't know why. I think the public's right to know, certainly, that there was an explosion, maybe what kinds of things were in the bomb. But I don't see why such specific evidence needed to be published just a day or two after by the Times. I think that I think there should be some soul searching there. Issues like the name of the bomber, where his neighborhood was, biographical information. I think when the press gets out, that public has a right to know those things. But the specifics, while investigation and before arrest have been made, I would think that the press could have waited and held that evidence until the authorities had gotten a little further along with their investigation to disclose it to the public. It's my personal view.
Well, it does appear that I don't think the British authorities are posturing. They seem to be genuinely angry. Is that your interpretation?
They have every right to be. You say that the Brits haven't shut off the intelligence flow, and I don't think they will. I don't think the Israelis are ever going to shut off the intelligence flow to the United States. We're going to continue to work together because this is a global problem, and we're stronger. All of us are stronger together than separate. That said, this is about trust. And if you have questions about trust or you lack trust, then you're going to be more reticent. The sharing won't be as fulsome, as robust, as quick, as cooperative. So these are relations that have to be nurtured over time. The relationships are person to person, agency to agency, government to government. And when things happen like this, you begin to fracture those relationships and they have to be rebuilt. So if an American intelligence source or a political appointee or somebody in the chain of command, did provide this information to American media that, the British didn't want them to do that, that is going to require some remediation, some apologies, investigation, and then trust-building measures back in the other direction to try to mend the damage.
And in terms of tracking, again, as we were saying earlier, there's an estimate that there's 300 jihadists who've returned to the UK from Syria and Iraq, and the idea that you'd have to track them 24/7 with all that surveillance is an extraordinary amount of manpower. But on top of that, Abedi, he had traveled recently, and I'm wondering how well the people's movements are tracked. He had just apparently been in Tripoli in Libya. He'd just been there for 3 weeks and returned days before the attacks. So this is again, what do we know about how these people are? We don't know the extent to which he was under surveillance, but the impression here is, of course, it's all in hindsight, is that somehow maybe he got his instructions back, in Libya, where he was 3 weeks, just days before the bombing.
Well, I agree. If you have a number of people who are known to have traveled to the Middle East, you don't have enough evidence to arrest them, and not anywhere in the Middle East, but you have suspicion that they were fighting with ISIS or they were in territory with the extremists, and then you find out that they traveled back, I would think that that would be a flashpoint that would open up an inquiry as to, what this, then the authorities should be interviewing him. Why were you in Libya? What did you do? Talking to their neighbors, talking to imams, see if they demonstrated any suspicious behaviors. So I think MI5 has lots of questions to answer with this, respect to this case. Again, I'm not one to point fingers when hindsight is 100% 2020 when you're dealing with an attack that has occurred. And you can always look backwards and say, why didn't you do this? Why didn't you do that? So I'm not accusatory at this point, but I do think, as you point out, there are plenty of questions that should be answered as to why this individual, having had the record he did, the tips off from the parents, the travel to a war-torn state, why there wasn't more inquiry into him that, you know, possibly could have prevented this tragedy.
Well, just in closing, David Shanza, what do we know about how you track and interdict bomb makers? Obviously, the manufacturers of explosives are closely watched, but I believe that the Islamic State Online have all kinds of bomb making formulas that they put out. So is it the case that you can basically get stuff from pharmacies and over the counter and put them all together and come up with these kind of explosives?
Well, Ian, I don't want to pretend to your listeners that I have expertise that I don't.
Right.
So you're pushing me a little bit. But certainly law enforcement and intelligence agencies, an agency like MI5, would certainly have relationships with manufacturers of or merchants of certain types of materials that they know are commonly used. So people who the vendors feel are suspicious, or they're not people that they know are using them for legitimate purposes, not regular customers, that they would probably have a system where they bring that to the attention of the place in the U.S. like the FBI or like MI5 in the U.K. But in terms of technical tracking and sensors and that's a little bit beyond my technical expertise.
But it is true that the formulas, homemade bomb formulas, are available online, right?
Well, yes, absolutely. I mean,
yeah.
The Tsarnaevs did not have any specialized experience or expertise, and they were able to create, it seems, from without any training. The first time they put something like these pipe bombs in the pressure cooker together to some very powerful explosions at the Boston Marathon. I think after the arrests and with trials, we'll learn a little bit more about these particular bombs. The reporting so far is the authorities think that these were more highly sophisticated and more powerful than your usual homemade improvised device by amateurs. And I think that's why they think that there was a deeper network and more assistance than...
Did we just lose you? Hello, hello? We just lost him. And it appears that we have just lost this connection with David Shanza. And again, I've been speaking with David Shanza, who's a professor of the practice and director of the Triangle Center on Terrorism and Homeland Security at Duke University. Previously, he was a staff director for the House of Representatives Committee on Homeland Security, and he was served in the executive branch as special counsel to the Office of the General Counsel of the Department of Defense and as a trial attorney for the United States Department of Justice. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.